Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Full or part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
A great opportunity to get back together again. The professor is here, the publisher, the editor. Alan Chartok is back from a little time away. Ira Fussfeld, publisher of the Daily Freeman of Kingston, and I'm Rex Smith of the Times Union here for the Media Project. Alan, it's great to see you again.
Well, thank you, Ray.
He's only been gone a week.
Well, thank you, Rex. I knew it started with an R.
It was one of those guys. They all look alike.
Call me Irwin. Age.
Oh, dear. Well, go right ahead. Read some
mail. Wait a minute. Would you like to tell the vast Media Project audience where you've been all this time?
Yes. I was in Ireland.
Ireland. I've heard
with,
of that.
In Galway, which is on the west coast and is quite wonderful, remarkable, a student town, quite beautiful.
Is there a media angle to this?
There is, in that the Galway papers, and I think there are a couple of them, are chocked full of advertising and stories. It was like the old American papers. I mean, it was really something. And then we would take the national papers, like the Irish Times, and they, too, were giant and looked very successful for a country that, as you all know, is underwater.
Yeah.
I mean, every letter to the editor is, how could you have let those people lend us all this money? We were all millionaires for this thing. And now, because there was so much greed going on, and we're all screwed now, and that was it. But the papers were filled.
Well, maybe that's the problem. Maybe people are spending too much money on pointless advertising.
Well, were you there long enough to ascertain whether the fact that the newspapers look healthy is because the internet and social media and cable have not taken as big a hold over there as they have here?
I don't know. All I know is you could not be anywhere without somebody checking a cell phone for something. Mm-hmm. So I think it's as big over there as...
Yeah. Well, I was telling Alan before we went on the air, about 30 years ago when my newspaper was part of the Ingersoll Publications Company, Ralph Ingersoll Jr., planted a flag in Ireland, and they established one or more newspapers, or bought one or more newspapers there. And as I recall, 30 some odd years ago, their thinking then was Ireland was like the U.S. in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
and that the heyday of the newspaper industry, which was already beginning to fade away here, was still golden there. And so that's why I was curious. In 30 years, a lot can happen. 3 days, a lot can happen. But it's interesting to hear that the big papers are still apparently healthy.
Well, they certainly look healthy.
And around the world, though, this is the case. You know, if you look in Scandinavia, if you look in many of the European countries, the best newspapers in the world in terms of design, and I can't speak to the content because I don't read these other languages, but these are beautiful. Often they are stapled.
I wonder if in fact, if we start from the premise that they are healthy and successful, if that speaks to the culture and that people in those countries are still readers and they're not, you know, viewers of TV and of taking the easy way out.
You beat me to the punch, Ira. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, you really got the feeling, at least I did, talking with people on the street and other places, that everybody seemed to know what they were talking about.
Yeah.
They didn't seem to be dumb.
So there's no dumbing down of Ireland. The dumbing down of America, but not necessarily of Ireland.
Well, maybe it does have to do with now we are, century into the television age. We are really into people just being passive viewers so much in this country. And while television obviously is big all over the world, it hasn't overtaken the media the way it has elsewhere.
You know we're going to get letters on this, which means you could write to Media.
Media at WAMC.org. We don't shy from controversy. Give us one here, Dr. Chartok. What mail do we have?
Hi, I'll give you one. Sent to me, as a college professor of mine used to say when discussing Rush Limbaugh on the Media Project, you have missed the point exactly. Freedom of speech, while a right, was always limited by libel, slander, obscenity, and incitement to a crime. What you should discuss is if Limbaugh's characterizations of Sandra Fluke, a private citizen, was libelous. If his suggestion that she film her sexual acts and put them on the internet was obscene. If so...
Well, they might be libelous.
Wait,
but...
if so, don't you think so? There were, and should have been, consequences, including advertisers dropping support. What is free speech is the larger and more important issue. I enjoy the show, as I do all of the WAMC programming, but enjoy the Media Project most when you all don't talk at once. That should be a lesson to both you and Rex, yeah. Ira. Best wishes.
She didn't write that.
Best wishes, as always. And now that you are back, set them straight.
Yeah.
Carol.
Well, go ahead. Set us straight.
What? I had enough trouble reading it, talking about dumbed down.
Well, he may have been liable. He may have libeled that woman, and she could take action against him. Well, actually, she was not libeled. She may have been slandered. You can't libel somebody on the radio. But if she wanted to go and take on Rush Limbaugh and then face the inquisition that would follow into her personal life, I think she should be very pleased that so many people took her side and move on.
But you know, you make a very good point. If you sue somebody, you're going to have to stand up before some lawyer who's going to say, well, he called you, you know, a prostitute. Have you ever prostituted yourself?
Right.
Have you ever engaged in intercourse with anybody who wasn't your husband? Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to answer those questions. A lot of people don't like to do that.
Yeah, it does sound slanderous, but I don't think she would want to go through exactly that. And plus, she is a public figure. It depends upon what state suit against Limbaugh would have to be filed.
She's a public figure because she injected herself into the limelight.
Yeah, she put herself in. She started testifying for Congress and so on. So there would be a standard in this state anyway that would be a little bit higher. But I think she could probably, on the question of she's a prostitute, she's a slut, she could win if she wanted to go through with that.
She would have to get herself a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So there are plenty of lawyers who would take that case, I suspect, just because of the publicity value. On the other hand, if you can't, you have to pay for the lawyer. That costs a lot of money. And I, for one, think, Rex, that, and I always have thought, that if you're libeled, you're libeled, and if you're a public figure, it shouldn't matter.
Hmm.
And I have always disagreed with the Supreme Court on that. I always thought it was stupid.
Well, there you go.
I mean, if you say something to me and you say, well, you know, you did something terrible and it's wrong, why shouldn't I be allowed to sue?
You are allowed to sue.
I'm allowed to sue.
Just that the standard that is applied is if you have to prove gross negligence on the part of the media as opposed to a slightly lower standard that is for a private citizen.
You don't mean
which
slightly.
Is reckless disregard.
You don't mean slightly.
Well,
I mean
the general words, reckless disregard for the facts or gross negligence, you know, how would you define those terms?
Well, but generally there is a sense among public figures that you won't get to first base because you are a public figure. You're quite right in terms of the definitions that you've offered us. And then they keep expanding what a public figure is. Somebody goes to testify before Congress and is, as you just suggested, has injected herself into the limelight and becomes a public figure. Mm-hmm. Doesn't seem right to me somehow.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, anyway, we have another letter from a reader who wants us to talk about Mike Daisy. Mike Daisy is the performance artist who most notably went on This American Life, which is aired on many public radio stations, including where this program originates, talking about the practices of Apple in Asia and some of the terrible work conditions there. Some of it turns out not to have been true. In fact, what he was doing was performance art, he says, not journalism. And This American Life aired an entire program investigating and apologizing for it. And
NPR sent out a thing to everybody saying, not us, them.
But the fact is, it raises a question about, I suppose, this reader suggests that if the staff of This American Life and Ira Glass are, in their anger, missing the full extent of their miscalculation, that they should have seen all along that this was coming, that the professional and aesthetically sophisticated staff of This American Life, says this writer, says Phil, is very hip to theatrical technique, and how could they have allowed themselves to think that they were in fact dealing with a piece of journalism?
Well, I don't think This American Life was the only one who thought that. I mean, for those who don't know, and the only reason I know is I've seen clips of the guy on TV, is Mike Daisy sits down at a desk in front of an audience and gives a monologue on what he sees and apparently or allegedly had learned about the treatment of the workers in China who produce the popular Apple devices. And I've not seen the playbill, nor have I seen the billboards, so I don't know if it says that this is performance art, or if you bought a ticket to this presuming that you were hearing, in effect, a lecture by someone who was a performer who seemingly had factual information to tell. So as a result, he has received a lot of publicity and has undergone a number of interviews from news sources, including one prominent one I saw on CBS, which was backed up by a video of the factory. So I may be missing something in terms of how he purported himself, but I don't know that it had ever been suggested that what he was doing was not true. You know, he says he's not a journalist, okay, but I don't believe anybody walked into that show thought that he was making anything up.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the way you understand it?
Yes.
Yes. That being the case, then why would This American Life be more vilified for the coverage and the time that they gave him as opposed to others?
Well, you have to understand public radio is, you know, the apex of truth and justice and, you know, good journalism. And they see themselves as better than the average journalist, as we saw when this great hoo-ha came out of NPR to all of us saying, just don't forget, it's not NPR, it's This American Life. I don't like that one bit.
Well,
it stinks.
The fact is, the one thing that you can say, it's unfortunate that because what Mike Daisy did was to focus international attention on this issue in a way that the straight reporting had not done. The New York Times did significant reporting last year about the kind of abuses going on in these factories in China. Foxconn, actually, is the factory where the company that had the factories in China, where Apple produces a lot of its machines. And the Times did this, and it did not focus attention on it as much as Daisy's telling of the story. Mm. Now, this was embellishment on his part. It was just very much like Janet Cook at the Washington Post so many years ago when she invented a 9-year-old heroin addict who did not exist. She was telling a truthful story of drug abuse in the poor neighborhoods of our nation's capital, but she made up a character, a supposed composite, and she had to give back the Pulitzer Prize that she had won as a result. Daisy did something similar. He did embellishment that started to produce reform. It is not allowed, but you begin to see where the line, actually very interesting, Michael Wolff, a media critic, draws the line, the straight line from Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, which was truthful storytelling with scenes created that recreated events that he didn't see. And that was the beginning, I think. It was around that time, of course, that new journalism developed as well, where you get sort of fictional storytelling techniques applied to straightforward journalism. And that's kind of what Daisy did, except that he actually made up scenes and individuals.
Well, that's all very well. You've described it so nicely, Rex. But people who are listening may be a little confused as to what your views on the ethics of this situation.
Oh, I think it's absolutely wrong. I don't think you can, you know, you should trust a journalism program. If you're listening to This American Life, which I think purports to tell the truth, you should be able to trust that what they're telling is the truth. Except that, you know, when they put on David Sedaris, you know that he's telling some
gilding
humorous stories. Yeah.
Well, but then again, if we start from the premise that they did not know that Daisy was embellishing.
Right.
And then they have Daisy on the program because what Daisy has had to say about Apple is very interesting. It, in fact, has had Apple respond by saying we're going to do better by our people there. And then Daisy comes on the air and he's questioned. And then at that point, Daisy does not own up to the fact, well, you know, I've embellished a little. Now, it seems to me I read somewhere where they asked Daisy that after the fact. And Daisy said, well, I was sort of flustered and I didn't know how to answer the question. Mm. Well, that bothers me because I'm starting from the premise that This American Life and the other media that interviewed this guy thought he had something interesting to say and factual to say. They put him on their air and questioned him about this subject, and he did not raise the curtain you know, he didn't come out from behind the curtain like the Wizard of Oz to say, well, don't forget, I'm a performance artist. He let them continue to the interview.
Well, that's all very good. But do you guys have an iPhone?
No, I have an iPad.
I have an iPad. And an iPhone. You have an iPhone?
No, I have BlackBerry, but I have an iPad.
But the thing is, the little white wires that you put in your ears and you plug into the phone?
Yeah.
That doesn't work on my iPhone anymore.
As a result of this, you think? I see.
I see.
Well.
Well.
Trace it to the source.
But maybe this goes back to what Alan was saying about the people in Ireland seem to be reading these newspapers. The problem today is that fewer people seem to feel compelled to seek out real journalism. Maybe it's because we're not entertaining enough. Mm. And you get a storyteller like Mike Daisy and people are suddenly wowed by it. You know, do you have to lie to get people to pay attention to important stories?
No, but Rex, as you've lectured to me so many times, and appropriately, I would to say, you know, we have to make these stories a little bit more interesting, and there has to be some more first-person narrative in some of them. So some people seeing that, knowing that newspapers are going in that direction, which, by the way, you see a lot of in Ireland and in the English newspapers, they may just take that as license to go a little too far.
Mm-hmm. I think people do. Years ago, 20 years ago, I was the... is that right? 20 years ago? Yes, I was the editor of the paper in Troy. And we had a reporter covering a federal trial out in Binghamton, I think, that had been shipped out there from Troy. And I got a phone call from a prosecutor one day about the fifth day of the trial. And he said, you know, I just thought that you'd like to know, I'm the deputy counsel on this case, prosecuting this case. He said, what's going on in the courtroom? He said, bears little resemblance to what's being reported in your newspaper. And I said, really? Because they were really compelling stories that I had been reading by our reporter out there. You know, what do you do in that circumstance when you're suddenly told that there has been some apparent, let's just hope that it was misunderstanding rather than fabrication on the part of the reporter in the covering of the trial? We immediately brought him back, you know, and sent somebody else out there to finish up the last day and a half or something of the trial. But it...
And it, was the allegation correct? The stories had not been done correctly?
It seems that there had been some embellishment. Wow. Now, there was some question as to whether the reporter might have had hearing problems that he didn't want us to know about. Mm. I don't know if that's the case to this day. But when you find that there is that kind of a problem, and I haven't encountered that kind of thing much in my career, but if you have something like this going on in your newsroom, like Jason Blair at the New York Times, that's a very serious matter, and you have to squelch it, which is what I think This American Life did. They really went overboard, appropriately, I shouldn't say overboard, they really aggressively sought to kill this thing.
You think they didn't want to get sued, that might be part of it?
Oh, no, I don't think that was it. I think it's their reputation.
Yeah, I thought it was the reputation. They it's an admired program on an admired network, and they wanted to make sure they cleared the air.
Yeah, absolutely.
And survived.
But it does raise a question when we editors push people to give us more interesting stories, are we urging people to take liberties when we ask for more interesting writing, more voice in stories? Are we putting a little bias into it? We have a column in the Times Union called The Advocate, in which a columnist actually takes the side of people who we think have been somewhat mistreated by officialdom or by big businesses. And it has voice and it has a point of view, and that's a little bit dangerous.
Yeah. You know, Rex and Ira, I have to tell you that quite frequently we'll get letters here from people from a group that's lobbying the DEC that doesn't agree with some of the things that the Department of Environmental Conservation may say or a decision. And they'll be long and they'll be turgid and they'll go around bends. And, you know, you just have to really at some point say, okay, this is now opinion as opposed to, you know, factual response to something that has been on the air. So you have to support your people, you know, if it's just an accurate report.
Well, I was just going to say, and maybe it's changing over the years because we're all editors and publishers of newspapers listening to the public more, shall we say. But I think that our default position historically when we would get those kind of complaints or the one that you just mentioned was to say, nah, that there's no way.
Yeah, right.
There's no way I sent a reporter to Binghamton to do a trial and he's screwing it up. This must be the prosecutor who feels somehow his case is not being reported to his favor.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's, since the Jason Blairs of the world, there's more of an inclination on our part to say, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. You take it a lot more seriously when you hear it. It used to be, and you know, there's a pressure on an editor from the newsroom to stand by your reporters.
Yes.
People say, boy, he stands with his staff. But your responsibility really, you know, is you have three constituencies, really. The staff who works for you, the enterprise you work for, and the community that you report to. And if your staff is not doing a good job of reporting to the community, that imperils everything. So you have to pay attention to claims of bias or inaccuracy, that kind of thing.
Well, I sort of hope that that This American Life survives this because Ira Glass, who is the host of the program, is the second most famous Ira who appears on WAMC.
Yes.
And I don't want to drag down the name.
And in fact, the roundtable here, one of our programs once did Ira Day.
We did an Ira Day. All the guests
were named
Ira. I was here in the studio. Ira Glass was on, and there was that we had
somebody from the Irish Republican Army.
I was thinking that, as well as somebody who had some money taken out.
But there was also, we had, I believe, the town clerk of a town in Vermont or someplace named Ira. The town was named Ira. So I digress.
That's a wonderful thing. Well, you know, but this is a different matter. This question about accuracy or bias is a little bit of a different matter from what Newt Gingrich is doing these days.
Yes.
Gingrich begins the answer to every question by attacking the elite media. He says, the thing I find most disheartening of this campaign is the difficulty of talking about large ideas on a large scale because the news media can't cover it, and candidly, my opponents can't comprehend it. We aren't capable of understanding somebody as smart as Newt Gingrich.
What one word sort of explains all of this? It's called scapegoating.
Ah, there you go.
Well, would you say his definition of elite media is?
All of us.
All of us. I mean, is there any more elite media than the WABC radio network, which has mostly conservative commentators who would be inclined to agree with Limbaugh? Is there any more elite media than the Fox News Channel, which is the single largest rating of cable news, which is essentially leaning towards that point of view? I mean, that's just nonsense. I mean,
Well, it is nonsense, but it's productive for him because he's running in a primary. He's got these right-wingers all trying to outdo each other, and he knows if he attacks the elite media, it's going to resonate.
And by the way, a lot of his attacks of the elite media appear on the elite media and on the Meet the Press and the networks and in the New York Times.
Sure, it's good for them, too, because then they can, you know,
there
just
was
get a lot of listeners.
Yes. Well, I heard a very hard-edged interview of Gingrich on NPR on Morning Edition that was pressed him on his claim about the failure of the Obama administration to hold down gasoline prices by producing more oil. And the reporter said, with a lot of facts at his disposal, the reporter said, but with all due respect, Mr. Speaker, in fact, oil production has increased during the Obama administration. It was going down during the previous Bush administration. We are, in fact, moving away from reliance on foreign oil. And it really pushed him appropriately to try to stand behind the facts that he was distorting. That's good reporting.
And Stephen Skeep, was it?
I think it probably was, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And similarly, President Obama was pushed hard by a reporter for the business show that Marketplace.
Marketplace.
So I think good reporting pushes politicians aggressively, whichever side of the
aisle. And the partisans, of course, will only remember the interview that they believe is too tough on their guy.
See, if you're up at 4 o'clock in the morning, the BBC has this program, Hard Talkers. But the guy goes on and he destroys whoever he's talking to. Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister of Ghana, whatever. Coming on, and you only have one question. Yeah. Why would this fool come on this program?
What are you doing there? Well, and why would people listen to this? No, because it's been very interesting. Gentlemen, wonderful to be together here.
Yes.
You know, the professor, the publisher, and the editor. That's Dr. Shartok, Ira Fussfeld, and Rex Smith. Thanks for joining us.
Tis a wonderful thing.
Off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk.